my cancer diagnosis at the age of 32, my mom and I talked a lot about the shock of that diagnosis, given several doctors told us you're too young to have endometrial cancer. After much discussion, we began to feel driven to inform and help educate other young women about what symptoms they should be concerned.
Having both been teachers, it seemed natural for us to look for a way to share Alex's cancer journey in order to help other young women avoid such a shocking diagnosis or possibly navigate a similar path. A podcast seemed the best way to get the word out, and that's how Down There Aware was born.
4 years later, our mother-daughter duo has gone from educating and informing to advocacy and action, with a fresh and sometimes very interesting and somewhat humorous multi-generational perspective.
We look forward to sharing with you season 4 as we advocate, take action, and make it a priority to always be
Down There Aware. Welcome back to another episode of Down There Aware. And just like that, we have different clothes.
After 5 weeks.
And
actually, we don't have different clothes.
We have the same clothes.
And they're PJs.
You can't see my top, but these are our peach PJs. We got these after my diagnosis, little camaraderie after my surgery.
And, we have a lot of matching PJs because a lot of surgeries.
Yeah, every surgery one of us has, we get matching PJs. It's just a thing
we recover together.
We do. Yeah, and so we actually, if you go on our website, we did a photo shoot.
Oh, I forgot about
that. We did a photo shoot in our PJs. So Dad, took pictures of us. It was a fun day.
You know, anything to distract us from reality.
That is all we can ask for, right? Like, yeah. Just trudging through. So we are back. We made it safely back. Mom and I didn't get COVID on our international trip.
But
my dad did. So
yes,
he has been quarantined, testing, and today was his first negative test. So we're waiting another 48 hours. Before he can come out of the cave, as we've been calling it.
And that's been after 2 weeks. It's been 2 weeks since we got back from Germany.
Yeah, because he didn't show signs until a couple days after we got back. And immediately we all tested. It was before I went back to work. So we all tested. And Mom and I have just been negative.
Every time.
Every time. Yeah. So it... Dad had never had COVID before, and Mom and I have had it. And so we think maybe that had something to do with it.
Yeah.
But regardless.
He's on the mend.
And being sick is never fun.
No.
But I think it was a pretty mild case compared to others. He was also vaccinated. And so, so that's what we've been doing.
And speaking of that Germany trip, oh, my goodness.
We could have a whole month of vlog or what are we doing? Podcast. just devoted to talking about our trip. It was that incredible, that magical, that
magnificent.
Everything I wanted it to be and more.
Yeah, that was awesome.
It was just really, really cool. I will say, I think our listeners would enjoy hearing just a couple anecdotes in regard to, because one of our episodes recently we did traveling with chronic illness, and a couple things came up.
The first day we got there.
Not just the first day we got there, but literally our plan was we landed in Munich at the airport. And if you are familiar with that city at all, the airport's about a 45-minute train ride into the city. We were staying at a hotel very close to the main train station there.
Which is kind of like Grand Central Station.
Yeah, yeah. And it's where all the regional trains come in and all that. But there's also, it's the main hub of the subway and things like that. So got on the train, it was fine, all this stuff. And once we got to the train station, we were navigating our way to the surface because we had taken the underground.
And we all had our suitcases.
We had our suitcases trudging along behind us. And note, we were there for 2 weeks in winter. So not only did we have 2 weeks of clothes, but I mean, you repeat some stuff, but like for the most part,
they were big clothes,
they
heavy,
were heavy
clothes.
Sweaters and coats and boots, scarves and boots and all of that. So,
well, another thing to note is, I don't know if it's all of Europe or just Germany. Well, specifically, they don't have an ADA.
No, they don't have an ADA. And so for
or
those
anything
of,
like it.
For those of you who are unaware, because we do have some international listeners, the ADA is the Americans with Disabilities Act. And it is a federal guideline of the accommodations that public places and businesses have to, who serve other, you know, serve the public, they have to adhere to all of these accommodations, and it's updated frequently.
Yeah.
Based on technology and things. And so, the cracks in the sidewalk, the space between, you know, the blocks and the sidewalk, they can only be a certain size, leveling of things, how long ramps are. You have to have
ramps.
You have to have ramps. You have to have elevators. You have to have wheelchair accessible things. Like, you can't just rely on escalators and stairs, because not everyone can use stairs and escalators. So as three Americans who are, by the way, now our trip there was just magnificent. It was amazing. And but no matter what, even laying down flat, I can't sleep on a plane. And so,
yeah, we were tired.
We got there at 9 a.m., not having slept all day. And it was so 9 a.m. Germany time was 3 a.m. our time. So we had been up all day, all night. So we were tired, dragging heavy bags over streets that were not intended to be dragged on with heavy bags.
And we had to drag heavy bags up escalators,
right? Because
it was either escalator or stairs.
It was either escalator or stairs. There were, I saw as we continued our time there, I saw elevators here and there scattered about, but they certainly weren't super accessible. And it wasn't like every time you had to go up, or you're, you know, were following signs and it was going in a certain direction, that there was an elevator there. You would have to hunt for it.
Well, and those Germans are accustomed to that, and they just dragged their bag up on that escalator and up they went, and it was no big deal.
And you see all over the states signs by escalators that say no strollers, no this, no that. I can't tell you how many people I saw with babies in the strollers, just ploop, yeah, right up on top of the escalator.
It was not a
like
thing.
It was nothing.
No.
So
all that being said, we are on our first escalator going up to the surface. And I had a huge bag, and it had a carry-on on top of it. And when I got it onto the escalator, it was not set straight and evenly. And I knew that. And I tried to very carefully maneuver it. And as I did that, I began to tilt backwards. And some generous, kind German held his arm out and stopped me.
Just kind of pushed her up.
So I didn't fall backwards. And I just said, oh, thank you, Lord, because I thought this is the end here.
Not the way to start a trip.
Not the way. And we got to the top of the escalator. And as I tried to lift the suitcase enough to get it over the little hump, my legs just gave out. And I've had that happen a couple other times, and I have knee scars to prove it. And I fell on the top of the escalator, just face planted. And Alex and George and the two Germans came to my rescue and got me up and got me out of the way, and the suitcase and all out of the way, because people were coming. I mean, it's Grand Central Station practically.
Well, and it's an escalator.
Yeah.
Escalators, they don't stop.
They can't stop.
They're people movers. They just keep going, going, going.
So that's how we started the trip. And we're back to people traveling with a chronic illness. you know, I'm learning that I have to be really careful because sometimes that happens. My legs just quit working. And so I have to always be holding on. I have to be careful that I'm balanced. And that doesn't mean I can't travel. That doesn't mean I won't travel. It means that's something I just need to be conscious of. And so for the rest of the trip, when we had to scoot around our suitcases, I took George's, which was the smallest, and I didn't put anything on top. It was just me and that little suitcase, and George and Alex handled the big ones. And, you know, we probably should have thought of that ahead of time, and we just didn't, because I'm really pretty healthy and get around pretty well. And
yeah, and it wasn't like, okay, well, how are we going to get mom's stuff? How are, like, no, because it's never, she can't carry something or you can't, yeah, you know, whatever. So it never crossed our mind. And also I recognized in myself that I tend to be impacted in like group environments. I'm impacted by the vibe that's happening. And everyone in that train station had somewhere to be.
Oh, and it was obvious.
Everyone had somewhere to go. And whether it was work or I don't even know. I don't really speak the language. But and I mean, but they and they knew where they were going. I thought I spoke the language. That's a whole other story. But they knew where they were going and they knew how to get there. And they were just beelining it. And so I kind of caught on to that energy. Mm-hmm. And I was like, we got to go. We didn't have to go. All we had to do was check into our hotel, and we ended up taking a nap and then going to, we had a dinner reservation that night. So it was a very chill. We didn't have a tour to go to. We didn't have somebody who was meeting us. We didn't, none of that. We could have like taken an hour to just walk across, but for some reason, and I was kind of leading the pack, I just had this like, oh, we have to go. So I made a conscious effort later on when we were traveling in public transportation and things to just take a minute and say, like, we don't have anywhere to be. We're not in a rush. Like, we just need to let people go by us, kind of stand to the side, you know, be more conscious
like
of that.
I know you've seen like a film and they want to do a time lapse. It's like if a camera was on that train station and they did time lapse and it was just zzz.
It would just be lines of people. Like you wouldn't even see people. You just see like just lines
go,
of color.
Go. So yeah. I can see getting caught up in that.
Yeah.
And it was easy to do. All in all, I had some skin knees and you know, a little issue with one of my knees, but nothing that kept us from doing anything we needed to do.
No, nothing. And, you know, we just were aware, and there were days that we had multiple tours booked and we had timelines that we needed to go. And then we just kind of balanced it out with other days where we would sit and people watch or casually walk around without an agenda, you know, in certain areas. Because obviously older European cities are very walkable. So we would just take our time and enjoy the culture and what was happening around us.
And the food.
And the food. Yeah. And I had a moment where, so I know we've talked about this, but I have a condition that was diagnosed when I was 15 called pseudotumor cerebri. And later on, it was reclassified as idiopathic intracranial hypertension. Essentially, I have just water on the brain, but I have shunts because of that and all that. But sometimes in different altitudes, I'll have, you know, some issues, not emergent issues, but just like I need to sit for a minute and just kind of relax. And
you call that a pressure.
And I just call it a pressure headache. Moment. Yeah. I'm having a pressure moment. I need to sit and relax. And so when we were on the top of the highest point in Germany, which is almost 10,000 feet.
The top of Germany,
Zugspitze. We had already gone up to we couldn't summit because of the weather, but we had gone up to like the top observation deck and we went back down and had a pretzel and hot chocolate. And Dad wanted to go back up to do some geeky thing on his phone. And so I was like, yeah, I'll go with you, take some pictures, whatever. And Mom was like, I'm going to stay in the warmth with my hot chocolate. I'm not going back. It was negative 17 degrees Celsius, which is about zero.
Yeah.
And it was snowing. It was very, very cold. So Dad and I went back up and we were walking up. There was just one flight of stairs. And I had to stop because I felt dizzy. And that like doesn't happen to me walking upstairs. I don't ever feel dizzy. And so I was like, well, that's weird. But I felt like that same kind of pressure. come to find out, I had my annual physical the week after we got back, and my blood pressure was incredibly low. So I think now looking back, it was probably just a low blood pressure, especially being up that high and with all the extra movement and stuff. So, but again, traveling with any kind of chronic illness, you just have to give yourself grace and space and say, okay, I, you know, can rush when I have to, but I'm going to need to take a minute. There was a moment at Zugspitze where, we left. So you go up, we took a train, a cog train up, and then we took a gondola cable car down. And that, I mean, like this cable car held like 200 people.
I mean, it's all glass.
And it's all glass. You can see, I mean, it's really cool. But when you get down to the point where the cable car lets you out, you have to catch another train depending on what town you're staying in and where your car is. So we heard the guy say the train leaves at 4 o'clock or whatever it was. It was like 3:45 and we had maybe not even, it was like 3:55. Like, and I was like, we have to book it. We have to go like get on this train, 'cause it's the last train for an hour. And we don't have an hour to spend in this area. I don't think you could do anything in that area for an hour. It wasn't exactly populated. And so I was like, I'm sorry, Mom, but we got to go. So Dad just grabbed Mom's arm and we just walked. And of course it was uphill.
I mean, literally ran. We ran. Yeah,
we just chucked it
and
over.
I just don't run. Between my knees and my heart in particular, I just cannot run.
Well, and when we got to the train, I was like, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. But we had to do it.
We made it
and it was fine. And you know, but we could prepare for that, right? Like we know that it's going to be tough. It's going to be short, you know, a short time frame that we're going to have to do something difficult, but we're going to do it. It'll be fine. And then it was leisurely after that. And
yeah,
you know, we could just walk at our own pace or whatever. But yeah, when you're trying to make a train, you sometimes have to sacrifice a little bit.
But that kind of ties in what we talked about traveling with chronic illness. You know, you can do it, and you just gotta be aware and be careful. So
yeah, and you shouldn't let it stop you.
No.
Or the fear of, oh, well, what will happen if this, you know, or whatever. And let me tell you, this is probably TMI, but traveling messes with your bowels and your guts and everything. And so sometimes you might need some medical help, over-the-counter stuff to help get things flowing. And just be cautious in Europe to know where the bathrooms are and to make sure you have the right coins.
Because you have to pay for most bathrooms.
Most bathrooms you have to pay for them. Now, it was really cool on the roadside stuff. You would pay and you'd get a little voucher and then you could like buy something in the convenience store. So that for one for one. So that was fine. But yeah, don't get caught in a train station almost at an emergency level. Everything was fine. Everything worked out. But just be careful. And be aware and make sure everybody has coins in their pockets for the pay toilets.
Oh, that was a great trip, though. Great
it was awesome.
Trip.
Well, we thought today, you know, I was thinking, what are we going to do? We just did this great big series and about all this world information. And lately, I've seen a lot of stuff come across my news feed, whether it's on TikTok or Instagram or Facebook or whatever.
Or your mom sending it to you.
Or my mom sending me things of people, particularly young people, but people who had some weird symptom that was ignored by their doctor that ended up being a catastrophic diagnosis later on down the road. And it just hit me like, this can't happen that often. It just can't be like that often. So I thought, I'm going to Google. I'm just going to put in a quick Google search. So I think my exact words were like, woman symptoms found out ignored. Like, I mean, like very, you know, not even a full sentence. And I tell you what, Paige,
I'm not sure I understand.
Oh, Siri wants to get involved. Sorry, Siri. But page after page after page of news articles from across the globe of people, not just women, but people who had symptoms, went to their doctor. And there was a variety of responses from the physicians. It was either you're too young, let's do some other tests. You have this other regular common thing that's not very serious. Or some people were actually laughed at and ridiculed. So I pulled out a couple of those that I thought we could focus on today that it really is just blowing my mind. And it's kind of a Ripley's Believe It or Not moment.
Yeah, we really just kind of shake our heads when we read these. But then again, we're not shocked because of your experience. We're just more sad because it just keeps happening. And these that you pull that we're going to talk about today, every time I was reading through them, I just kept thinking, we've got to get the language put on period products to enlighten young women. A lot of them said, I didn't know these were symptoms of cancer. I had no idea.
Because some symptoms, bloating.
Yeah.
People get bloated all the time. Women get bloated on their periods all the time. But when it's excessive or when it's, you know, painful or constant, those are the, you know, types of symptoms that we're talking about. So you want to kick it off?
Well, yeah, we read in the Washington Post about a girl named Hannah who had frequent urinary tract infections. She had irregular periods, bloating, constipation, diarrhea, and extreme pain. She says she went to almost a dozen physicians. Now, just think about that.
Just the time it takes to get an appointment with a physician. I mean, how long was that process? 3 years?
3 years.
And that's incredible.
And she said that they all dismissed her, said she was healthy. It was probably nothing. She probably had too much stress. That's what the consensus was.
Oh.
They also told her, and I know both of us have heard this at one time or another, that she was overweight and losing a few pounds might ease her symptoms.
Yep.
And we are the first to say carrying around too much weight is not healthy for you.
We can tell the difference in when we've lost weight, how our bodies feel, how we have more energy. It makes sense.
Yeah.
However, it is not the root of all evil. And in terms of the medical world, and you know, if being fat caused cancer, every fat person would have cancer.
Yeah.
If it was a causation thing, then you would see it across the board.
I do think because doctors have concerns about people carrying too much weight, which is valid, many of them tend to go to that first.
Well, and I think it's lazy. In sometimes, I think,
and easy,
and it's an easy, lazy thing to not have to investigate something. I mean, we've talked about this before, but when I was diagnosed with PTC when I was 15, the first neurologist I saw. Now, to put this into perspective, I had not been able to eat or walk or do
or
anything
sleep.
Or sleep for over a week. I had been to a pediatrician every single day. I had been tested for TB and tetanus and encephalitis. I mean, like, I had been tested for everything. Nothing came back. And they sent me to the emergency room when they saw papilledema in my eyes. And his first thing, now I was losing my vision at this point. I was already seeing double.
Lost your peripheral.
I was having a peripheral, you know, kind of tunnel vision situation. And he wanted to take a conservative approach, put me on a diet. Now, mind you, I'd already lost 15 or 20 pounds in a week because I was so sick. And he just wanted to take a conservative approach because he said I had this disease because I was fat.
Yep.
And like, you see me now, I weighed a lot less when I was in high school and, you know, but to call it like that, I think that was a lazy I do too. Because we said we want a surgical consult. We want a consult. And he saw me and said, surgery tomorrow. Like,
the surgeon saw you.
The surgeon. Yeah. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. We are operating on you now.
Yeah.
So that's what I mean by a lazy, easy diagnosis. And again, we're not generalizing to every physician or every medical practice. Not at all. Because I, you know, wouldn't have gotten the care I got if I didn't have great doctors in my path. But we are pointing out that it's not uncommon for physicians to take the easy route.
Well, and in Hannah's case, she ended up, it's a long story, but in essence, she was in so much pain 3 years later, she went to the emergency room. And good for them, they did some specific testing, CT, transvaginal ultrasound, and they found a 4.5-pound, 8-inch tumor on her ovaries. I mean, 4.5 pounds, 8-inch tumor. It had been obviously growing all that time. And it came back with stage 3, I think it was. Stage 3 ovarian cancer. And what she got from all this is people my age, her age, 24, don't know the signs and symptoms. And doctors need to become better versed in recognizing the signs and symptoms. And so those are the two things she's advocating for.
Mm-hmm.
Getting the word out to young women and trying to get doctors better informed.
It's just unacceptable that in the course of those, 12 doctor visits over multiple years, that no one said, let's do a test. And I think a lot of it is insurance. And
I was just going
to
say,
we definitely have a crappy system that it needs to be reformed. But to ignore it for that long, it really, and something else that I think we are also advocating for is structured patient advocates, because clearly Mom and I have done this enough where we speak up for ourselves if we need to, we ask questions if we need to, and we just make sure that we're as informed as we can be. We do research, we come back to the appointment with things and more questions, and not everyone is like that. And it's not their fault, right? It's not a negative thing. It's not, you know, not everybody makes their hobby their medical care.
Well, but I think we're like that because we have had so many experiences.
Right.
And we've learned that you have to be like that. I learned it very early on when our son Will was young. He was born with something called a pectus excavatum, where his chest caved in. And at birth, they said, we'll just keep an eye on it and we'll see if it's going to cause him any problems. Well, when he was 4, the pediatrician finally said, you need to get a surgical consult. It looks like he's going to have it corrected. And excuse me. So we went to 2 different hospitals and had consults, and they decided to do a chest cavity reconstruction on him. I said all that to say, our insurance company said they were not going to pay for it because it was cosmetic surgery. And I can't even tell you how appalled I was at that. I would put my 4-year-old through such a horrific surgery because I cared about what he looked like without a shirt on. I mean, the doctor had already told us his stomach had been distended into his abdomen. His heart had been displaced over further to the left. His shoulders were rolling forward. And when I asked, what if we don't do anything? What if we don't have it corrected? You know, what's the risk? And the doctor said he can have a heart attack because his heart doesn't have room to grow and operate. So clearly he had to have the surgery. Well, I had to call the insurance company, and I can't even tell you how many days I had to call the insurance company and keep asking for the next person in charge. And finally, they put me through to a doctor who approved and disapproved the various surgeries. And he's the one who had said it was cosmetic and, you know, they weren't paying for it. And so I, of course, had read a lot about it, and I had the notes from Will's doctor. And so I educated him over the phone why it wasn't cosmetic. And he took pause and said, well, he would have to confer, blah, blah, blah. And I said, let me just ask you a question. What is your area of expertise in medicine? And he was like a gastro doctor. I mean, nothing to do with the anatomy in regard to the chest cavity, not a heart, you know, cardiologist, nothing. Eventually, they did approve the surgery. But my whole point in all that is I had to push, and I wasn't ugly to anybody. I wasn't, you know, I didn't throw a fit, but I did my due diligence. I did my homework and I presented the case, and I would have kept presenting it, and I would have kept going further if I had to, because I knew it's what was best for Will.
Yeah. And that was the mid to late 80s where the internet was not a thing. If you wanted to do research, you had to go to a library. Yep. There. I mean, information was not nearly as accessible as it is now. And so just the time and effort and energy that you could put into that, you had just had another baby. Yeah. Like there was a lot going on in your life, but it was important enough to be your own advocate. And so I think that did teach you and in turn teach me, you have to speak up for yourself because you're going to get a random doctor who doesn't really know anything about your case.
Yeah. So I think the more you do it and the better results you have because you did it empowers you to continue being an advocate because you know it works.
I think so too. And you know, trial and error, you learn different techniques, different phrases that you should avoid or, you know, that are good to say.
You should use.
And so that is really helpful too. So another similar but maybe a little more exaggerated case.
I don't have that one.
It was at the very top of the thing. And this is actually the case that now that I'm remembering my process that got me Googling. Because I saw this and I was like, you have got to be kidding me.
Because some of them are just, believe it or not, you cannot.
I mean, it really sounds like something out of the Inquirer magazine.
Yeah.
Like it really is just crazy. So this 20-year-old, and this caught my eye because it's a relatively local story. She lives in Jacksonville. She recently, I'm going to wait till you're done drinking.
Okay, because you don't want,
I don't want you to spit it out. She recently had an ovarian tumor removed that weighed 104 pounds.
I just can't even.
And all her life, she, you know, said that for years and years, she had all of these symptoms and she would go to the doctor and talk to them and they would be like, you need to lose weight. You need to lose weight. But she remembers as a child, even being overweight, her stomach was rounded and it was firm and it really didn't, you know, it looked odd. And she said she felt like she was pregnant with like multiples because she was just so distended and large. And in addition to the tumor, 104 pound tumor, they also took off of her when they did the surgery, 46 liters of fluid.
Oh my gosh. I mean, just that's more than a person. And talk about a child. It's two children. I mean,
yeah. It really is just crazy to think that this had gone on and on for so long. And, you know, in this article, she's just saying how grateful she is, that she kind of has a second chance on life. You know, she instantaneously lost over 100 pounds of excessive weight that wasn't her fault.
Yeah.
And it was this horrific tumor. And so this really got my, you know, gears going in terms of Googling and how is this possible? How, and you know, people asked, how is this possible? But she was just ignored and ignored. And she says, it was also, you know, the height of the pandemic, and I was terrified to go out. I didn't want to try to find doctors. I also didn't have health insurance, so I just ignored my issues completely. And then she goes on to say that her symptoms persisted to where she couldn't stand for more than 5 minutes at a time. She couldn't drive a car because her stomach was so distended outward. She actually decided to go to a doctor when her mother was going through cancer. And she said, okay, I need to do this. And so she ended up finding a doctor and going to see them. And they took care of it locally right there in Jacksonville. And so it just goes to show you have to be your own advocate. It can be scary. I mean, I know going, you know, as an overweight person going into the doctor, you always have that in the back of your mind.
The first thing they do is weigh you.
They're going to ask you about, you know, how much you exercise and what you eat and this and the other. And I get that it creates this like full medical picture. But when you have such an obvious abnormality like that, and because her tumor wasn't like something sticking outside of her neck, right? It was internal. So all it did was push out and push out and push out and just make her look bigger. She was just ignored. She was never offered any testing, nothing. It was just, oh, you need to walk and lose weight and stop eating so much.
Well, and that makes me think about another one I read about, another 24-year-old who went to several doctors, and nobody, she said in retrospect, nobody even felt her stomach. You know, she went in for an exam with these issues. She had bloating and, let me see what else, blood in her stool, stomach pain. She'd lost weight and she could feel a mass in her abdomen, and doctors did not even feel her stomach.
I just don't understand. I mean, every time I go to the gynecologist, they, palpate your abdomen.
Well, these were GPs she had gone to.
But still, my annual physical, he had me lie on the ground, or on the ground, on the table, and he palpated. And he even said, this is the first time he's ever done this, he even said, I'm checking your liver. Like, and he, you know, he was like, breathe in, and he like, you know, whatever. He's like, I'm checking your liver and I'm checking that. Well, so, like, she
finally went to a gynecologist who sent her to a gastroenterologist, said, no, those things are not normal. So she called for an appointment and could not get in for 6 months.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah. But she said, I didn't have cancer in the family. You know, I'm 24. I just didn't feel like it was, you know, so, plus it, because she couldn't get in for 6 months, that made her think, oh, well, it's not serious.
Right.
Because they would see me right away. It must not be emergent.
Well, and it works the other way, too, because when I got my diagnosis, it was a Tuesday, and they said, we have an appointment on Friday. And I was like, oh, this must be serious if they're getting me in that
exactly.
quickly. And then at my appointment on Friday, she said, how's next Tuesday
for your surgery?
Like, oh, well, this must be super important. So it works the reverse way, too, because I didn't seek a second opinion. Mm-hmm. I just said, okay, yeah, let's do it. And I don't regret my decision at all, but sometimes I do wish that I had a little more time,
to process it.
I think I would have had a lot of less anxiety over the whole situation, but yeah, so it works in reverse too.
Well, and so it ended up, she had been planning to take a trip to Europe and thought, well, I can't see the doctor for 6 months, so I'm going to do it now. She was in so much pain, she called it indescribable pain, on the flight home, that the flight attendants cleared a row so she could lie flat. And she was immediately, upon arrival, taken to the emergency room.
Wow.
And it took that, going to an emergency room, they did a CT and a biopsy and revealed she had stage 3 colon cancer at the age of 24. And she'd been having these issues for so long and she'd been dismissed. And again, it goes back to, it's not only doctors who are kind of in this data-driven society in med school where they only certain ages get certain diseases. But it's the general public because of that,
right?
That she said, I felt like I was too young. I was too young to get colon cancer. She said, colon cancer never crossed my mind.
Well, and it's the same reason why at my last gynecology visit, now this is a gynecologic oncologist, and she walked in the room and she said, when was your last mammogram? And I said, well, I've never had a mammogram. I'm 36. And she said, oh, that's right. You're one of my younger patients. Most of our patients are in their 40s. And she said, you don't need to have one until you're 45. And so, you know,
See, that really bothers me.
With our history of breast cancer and things like that. Now, and we also talked about my genetic testing. I have tested negative for BRCA and all of those things. So I'm not at higher risk. But to just be dismissed like that of, oh, you're in this age, whatever. And I, trust me, I love statistics and I get the bell curve. I understand that the vast majority of people, and I also understand from a socioeconomic status standpoint, you have to think about the ROI, right? Like the cost of investing in certain things, you really need it to impact the middle percentage, right? Like not any of the outliers. And like, I get that, but at the same time, it just doesn't make any sense that these people are continually missed.
Yeah. And if it's you, the statistics don't matter.
Right.
If it's you, you know, you want to be looked at as an individual and treated as an individual. And I'm sure anybody who is diagnosed with these horrific diseases and conditions feel that way. I don't care if most people who get this are postmenopausal. I'm not, and I got it.
Right. And, you know, I have a friend who's going through a ton of testing right now. She just texted me the other day that she feels like a guinea pig. She's going through so much testing in terms of, and she's having gut issues. And I mean, she's my age, just a little bit younger, in her 30s, and she's had her first colonoscopy and all of these things, and it's coming back pretty inconclusive. And I'm glad they're doing all the testing, because I send her articles like this and I'm like, I don't want to scare you, but just keep in mind that just because you're in your 30s doesn't mean anything. And I think for somebody like me, who between my brother, we just call it weirdness, right? Like my brother's weirdness when he was a child, medical weirdness, and just having unique things. Like no one knows what a pectus excavatum is. Well, I did when I was a child, because that's what my brother had. And then me moving into adolescence and having all of my issues, I've always been the rare bird. Any new doctor I go see, they come in and look at my chart and they're like, so tell me your story.
Yep.
You know, and especially now, because it just continues. And at my my physical last week, my doctor was like, so your back surgery was the only surgery you had last year? And I had to think, I was like, yeah, it was. But for me, that's not abnormal to, you know, what surgery is going to happen this year? And so I think doctors, in my case, now that I'm through all of these things, they pay a little bit more attention. And when I say, like, this is out of whack, or this is a little, you know, I'm concerned about this, they know that not only do I have the experience with myself and with all of these other conditions, but that I'm up on research and things like that. But they should have, I think, that same kind of trust in the patient, even if you don't have a chart as full as mine.
Well, and that's why, once again, and I know we say this ad nauseum, but you have to advocate for yourself
constantly,
because if they see you are knowledgeable and are able to articulate what's going on with you, mm-hmm. and what your concerns might be, an example is when I saw my cardiologist before we went to Germany, one of my question or set of questions I wanted to ask him was, I'm going to Germany. Is there anything I need to be concerned mm-hmm. about traveling that far, the higher altitudes and all of that? And he said, well, what are you really concerned about? Because of my, I've been having atrial fibrillation. And what are you really concerned about with that? And I said, about having a stroke That's my concern. He said, you know what? You're on a blood thinner. We've pretty much got you regulated. You kind of have this flare up every now and then, but you're not in constant AFib. He said, I'm really not concerned about that. And that's all he had to say to me.
Yeah.
And it gave me peace of mind because I thought, well, he's the doctor. He knows his stuff.
Yep. And he knows you.
And he knows me.
And he knows your history and he's worked with you. And so, that vote of confidence from your doctor to say, like, have a good time.
Yeah.
It's just such a nice feeling when, you know, there's no like, okay, well, be careful of this and be careful of that. And
or no, you really shouldn't go. That plane ride would be too much for you or, you know. So, yeah, your doctor, it's so important to have a good relationship and to advocate for yourself and to kindly and respectfully state your case.
Yeah, it's super important. And, you know, kudos to all of these young women who eventually fought and fought and fought and figured it out no matter how many times they were put on hold or how many times they said 6 months from now or whatever it was, because they did get the treatment that they needed eventually.
And some, though, had to get a lot more treatment because their disease had progressed so
far. The prognosis is much worse the longer you wait. And so just making sure that you're on top of all of your checkups and everything. If you haven't had your pap smear this year, schedule it.
Yep.
If you haven't had your mammogram this year, schedule it. That is something that is super important and a necessary evil.
And if you're my age, get your colonoscopy.
Yeah, all of these things. And, you know, I can't speak for any other country, but in America, those three tests are all covered by insurance. They're all covered by Medicare and by Medicaid. So there really is no reason to not do them.
Yeah, it's worth taking the time and effort to do
it. It's just making the appointment.
Yeah.
And doing it.
Yeah.
So thanks for listening. A little bit of a longer episode today. Just super chatty.
Yeah.
It's been a while for
us. It's been a while, yeah.
Not for you, but it has been a while for us. So we are getting back into the groove. We thought we'd ease in with being comfy in our PJs today. But thank you for joining us, and we will see you next week. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Down There Aware. Be sure to like and subscribe on our new YouTube channel, as well as on your favorite podcast platform. You can find us at Down There Aware on all social media sites, Twitter, Pinterest, TikTok, Facebook, Instagram. If you have it, we're there at Down There Aware. You can learn more on our website, www.downthereaware.com, and always get in touch with us, downthereaware@gmail.com. See you next week.